Session number 20375, Reel 4.
We'll buy Reel 4.
The cartons of Anorex, and they turned out to be fleece-lined, upholstered jackets that were made of terraline, and they were waterproof, and they had a built-in hood, and we suddenly discovered that you could fight the cold if you had the right clothing. So we then found out that American troops are not allowed alcohol of any description in the front line. And 10 miles out of the line, they were allowed beer. But they have to go right the way back to their rear echelon before they are allowed spirits. They could not understand how a naffy wagon, and I mean the British Army could not function without the naffy. We are fairly phlegmatic, the British squaddy. He will take just about everything you throw at him, as long as his creature comforts. That is the basics. As long as he gets his tea, and even the sea rations, the compo rations, as long as that came, we would function. I remember there was one occasion when there was an actual battle was stopped. Well, not stopped, it didn't start. And whether it was a true story, but I certainly know for a fact that the battle didn't start on the day that we thought it was going to start. And the story went round that the American troops that were supposed to support us had decided not to fight because they hadn't had an ice cream for their tea the night before. And having seen their rations, we moved from sea rations, which was the British basic compo, to American K rations. And they used to get a packet which was one man for 24 hours. Each case of rations worked out that you had breakfast, dinner and tea for one man in these boxes, by giving you a crate, you had sufficient rations for four men for one day, so that was ideal for a tank. Whereas the sea rations were just X number of tins of beans, X number of whatever, tea, sweets, and that's a hard-boiled sweet in a case, and you then had to shuffle them around to make sure that you've got your correct bits. Whereas with the American rations, you discovered that C1, C2, C3s, then you found out that if you could get hold of C4, that actually had tinned salmon, as opposed to compressed meat and whatever. And they had cigarettes in every ration pack. And in every fourth pack, you got a Zippo lighter. And, I mean, they're silly, really. They're only bits and pieces, but it made us feel that we were second-class citizens compared with the Americans. I caught malaria while I was out there, and I was shipped back to a rear first aid post, and the difference between Americans and the English. I was in the recovery bay, and they have, they're not nurses, they're, I suppose it's very similar to the Women's Institute. But these girls used to look after the comforts and that sort of thing, bring you magazines and whatever. And I suppose they were nurses of sorts. But I always remember we were stretched out on the beds, and this sweet little thing came down and said, "For all you English boys, we've got a surprise for you. If you bring your mugs," because we all hung on to our mess tins and whatnot, "we've got a surprise for you down in the canteen." So, of course, there was a trundling all the way down to the canteen. And there was these two huge urns. And she said, "We've made you tea, because we've been living on either milk or coffee." And we, of course, there was a stampede down. And as we got down to the counter, you could see the ones at the front screaming to a halt, and the ones at the back were pushing up and pushing up. "Hold it! What's up?" "Dunno, but it ain't tea." So there's this poor kid, her bottom lip trembled. She's done the best in the world, and she made this for all of us. And there it was, a beautiful golden colour, and lumps of lemon floating about in it, and we're and ice cold. And we're sort of looking, and we said, "What's that?" "Tea." "That ain't tea." So she said, "But we're told you chaps always drink tea." So we said, "Yeah, but we drink English tea." So she said, "Oh." And somebody said, "Can we make our own?" So she said, "Certainly." So four or five of them went round the back, immediately heaved this stuff down the sink. 2 2-pound cartons of tea, 4 tins of evaporated milk, and 2 pounds of sugar. And you then stir that into boiling water, and it turns a dark, deep tan brown. And she looked at us, and she watched us, because the first thing that happens with tea leaves is that they all float to the top, so that you've got a quite a nice film of tea leaves over the top. And she looked at it, and then she looked at us, and then she looked at it again, and she said, "Are you going to drink that?" So he said, "Not yet." And he got an enlarged steel ladle and banged the side of it, and all the tea leaves immediately settled to the bottom. And we give it, "Hold it, wait, wait." And sure enough, bum, 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 all the tea leaves vanished. And that was it. And she scooped in, and we're drinking this stuff. And she looked. And she got the most daintiest cup you have ever seen. And she said, "May I try it?" So we've got this ladle. And she was ill. She just vanished in a cloud of white skirts and grey jacket and vanished out the back. But that was the best cup of tea we'd had in ages and ages and ages. And I think that the Americans had no... I've always said that we are people that are divided by the same language. Because they have no idea of what... I mean, there have been several... quite a number of Americans over in England during the war. But I don't think any of them were in Korea, because Korea was 5 years after World War II, and we were, 18. So we were teenagers, very young teenagers during the back end of the war. And it was the same with the Americans. They had quite a number of veterans, like us. But their core troops were young men. So they, again, were in exactly the same boat. They didn't know what the world was like outside of America. We didn't know what the world was like outside of England. And we weren't able to communicate. We could not understand their attitude. I think the thing that brought it home to me most was I was out of the hospital and I was in the holding unit, and we were told that we could use the PX in Wee Jumbo, and we went down there in our normal kit that the British soldier was issued with. And there was four of us. And we got to the gate, and there was this very shiny American MP with a white helmet, a white silk scarf at his throat, and a beautifully pressed, tailored uniform, highly polished boots and gaiters, and a club of about 2 foot 6, 3 foot in his hand, on a leather thong that he was quite happily swinging round his wrist. And when we got, he stopped and he held it. He said, "Hold it. Where are you going?" "In there." "You're not allowed in there." So we have a character called Albie Allen, who was a London East Ender. And he turned around and he said, "Sir, we're on your side, you know." So he said, "You're not allowed in here." So I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Because you're not allowed to work, come in here in fatigues." So four of us gathered together. A, what's fatigues? B, are you sure we've come to the right place? Because it was clean and it was polished and it... So one of the others turned and said, "It's probably the officer's mess." "Oh, yeah, that's it. We've come to the wrong gate." So I said, "Is this the officer's mess, mate?" "No, this is the all-ranks mess." I said, "Well, we're all-ranks." "He's a corporal, he's a lance corporal, and these are troopers. We're all ranks." He says, "You can't come in." He says, "You are in your working clothes." And Albie Allen had what you might call a short fuse. Because he turned around and he says, what do you mean? He says, that's your working dress. So I said, yeah. He said, well, you're not allowed in. He said, but these clothes are for fighting, fucking, and fornicating. He says, and that's all we get. And this Yank's face went white. And I have never felt so ashamed in my life, because he turned round and he put his hand in his pocket and he said, do you guys need a couple of dollars? And as luck would have it, Albie, for the first time in his life, I think, turned around and said, no thanks, mate. All we want is a cup of bleeding coffee. And he held the door open for us. And we got in there and we were fuming to think that our uniform wasn't fit to be allowed into their canteen. But when we got in there, we suddenly realised that everybody else appeared to be polished, even their troops. And apparently what happened is, when they come out the line, they were taken through, scrubbed, and then issued, there and then, on the spot, a completely new uniform, clean, fresh, pressed and everything. And then they were turned loose. We were slung on the back of a 3-ton truck. And I mean, we were clean. The stuff was clean, the stuff was pressed. But it wasn't quite what you might call 100% Savile Row.
There was one story you were telling me earlier about that officer who used the water, the new officer.
Oh, yeah.
You said, did you say the NCO threw the water away?
Oh, yes.
But yes. Would it have been of some use?
No. He was making a point. He was not... what had happened was, he'd taken the water and he'd put his soap in it. And he'd started to wash. And Bob just took the water and he threw it so that he couldn't use it. And what he was trying, the point he, I think he was trying to make, was that water was the most precious commodity. It was more important than ammunition.
But then why throw it away?
To make the point to this sweet young thing that he was not going to use it. He had, as he pointed out, if he wanted water, it's strange. Bob had been the troop commander for a long time, and I think he was, no, I don't think that's fair to say that he was feeling a little bit miffed at being supplanted with a young officer in place. We knew that we were going to get an officer eventually, but I think it was that the feeling that he had was, oh my God, I've got another one to look after. I think that was what it was. He'd already absorbed us and we'd helped. We'd had two or three young replacements from kids that one had got wounded, another one got shell-shocked, and they brought in. And then, as I say, we got this young thing straight out of the box. And I think it was just one of them days where, oh my God, I've got another one to look after. And that was the thing. It was the sergeants that made the troops, because most of these officers were young. Again, they were straight out of Sandhurst. they had most young officers in the British Army. I don't know what it's like today. It's probably worse today. Went to public school back in them days, to university, to Sandhurst, to their unit. And they had seen no life at all. And we had one young man who had, I think his father was somebody big in the Dunlop, his name was, so I think he, probably the rubber people, sort of probably the second or third son down the line, because that was the sort of thing that happened in them days. The oldest son took on the business, the second son became a priest, and the third one became a soldier. And when he first arrived, he wanted to know who was going to be his batman. And in base units in England and possibly Germany by then, officers did get batmen. But you don't get them. The colonel got a batman, but he also acted as his bodyguard and whatever. But it was a classic example of this young chap coming to a world that he never envisaged. He didn't believe that this sort of thing happened. He didn't realise that as part of the tank crew, he would have to get up one morning in four and put the kettle on to make the first brew, because that's how it worked. And it took him a long time to become a tank man. The first two nights, he would sit apart from us, simply because he didn't know how to talk to us. He had no idea of, I suppose our sense of humour was different to his. And we'd be sitting at the back end of the tank, which is usually the safest place to sit anyway. And we used to use what I suppose we call now fire lighters. And we could, sorry, we didn't. What we had was a 20 pounder shell case that had been V-cut, the bottom had been cut off, which left you with a tube of copper, of brass. You then cut two V's in the base, and that would stand in on the floor. And then if you had a halfway decent reamy mech, he could solder a biscuit tin so that it fitted over the tube of the shell case. And you could fill that with water, and then with a smaller tin of beans or whatever, 2-inch tin, you take the lid off of that, fill it with sand, fill that with petrol, put a match to it, and that would then make the shell case into a chimney. And that would suck the heat from that petrol up through this chimney. And that would boil the water in this biscuit tin. And that could boil, I suppose, a gallon of water in minutes. And they were amazing. It was called a Benghazi cooker. and it was again one of the Eighth Army methods of cooking water. And again, it was the old vets that had been through the desert and knew how to do it. And I think we went through, after we got ours, it was a case of finding someone prepared to make it. Because A, we didn't see very much of the Rimi. The only time you saw them is if there was something wrong with your tank and you were pulled out of the line and you were pulled back to the rear echelon. So you didn't see very many mechanics and whatnot. And so it was, that was only when, the only chances you ever got of getting them made and fixed. Or if somehow you could get a trip down the line on a water cart or whatever, you bum a ride down to the rear echelon and do it that way. But as I say, we kept all everything. Another thing that we got was trading with the Americans. There's an awful lot of black market that goes on during war. And by black market, I mean between us and other troops.
What's the difference between an ordinary market and a black market?
Black market's illegal.
So why was this illegal?
Well, you do not go to an American and say, they had the most ingenious things that they'd been designed in America, which was a pot-bellied stove with a drip feed, a section of rubber hose that went out through the side of their tent to a 50-gallon jerry can of petrol. And it would run down this drip feed into this container, and they would fill it with sand and earth. And it had a chimney. It looked very, very similar to these Wild West stoves that you see in the cowboy movies, except that they were squat and short. But they, as I say, you fill them with sand, light the petrol that had dripped through, and that used to get red hot. And they were fabulous. If you had two or three tanks together, whereby you then made a bivvy, invariably you slept, four of you, underneath a tarpaulin that came from the side of the tank to the floor, and you then slept underneath that. That kept the weather out. If there was the four tanks together of one troop all together, you could form a square with your canvas sheets, and you then had a fairly passable tent. And if you could get hold of one of these space heaters, as they were called, you were halfway toward glory. You were fighting the weather completely. You are fireproof. And we used to trade them. As I said earlier, they were not allowed alcohol in the front lines. So we would buy a crate of Asahi beer, which is a Japanese beer. I suppose it's the early forms of lager.